You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Julian Zabel Bayascoa about his story, Igerilaria, which appeared in issue 21 of The Common. Julian Zabel Bayascoa's stories have published or will appear in American Short Fiction, Copper Nickel, Electric Literature's The Commuter, The Gettysburg Review, Glimmer Train, Plowshares, and others. He earned his MFA in creative writing from the University of New Orleans. Now a visiting professor in the Honors College at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, he leads annual study abroad programs to Donosti, San Sebastian, Havana, and Madrid. Julian Zabel Bayascoa, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much.
Could you set the scene for our conversation, describe where you're living and calling from right now?
Yeah, I'm over here in Donosti and in San Sebastian at the moment. I'm standing at the window, so I'm going to lay it on pretty thick, if that's all right.
Please do.
Outside the window, so it's 8 o'clock or 8:15 now at night, which means that the sun is still high up in the sky because it sets at about 9:50 in the evening these days. So before me is the Urumea River. It's about, the tide is rising, so it's about halfway filled. The sun is just kind of like, you know, creating that sort of like gold foil on its surface. Before me is the Maria Cristina. It's one of the older hotels in the city. It's a 5-star hotel. Along its side, though, fascinatingly, is the bullet holes from the Spanish Civil War. They never patched them up, so they're still there. Further down is the old part of the city, so you get to see the red tiled roofs, steeple from the church, and it's nestled up against the Urgul. They call it a mountain, which is kind of aspirational. It's more of a hill than a mountain, but San Sebastian has three, you know, quote unquote mountains. Further, you know, kind of hazy in the distance, or at least silhouetted by the sun, is Igeldo. And then, yeah, off to the left, the river continues into the mountain range. Donosti is just kind of like the old part is the mountains nestled up against the coast. off to the right's the Bay of Biscay. So I'm here in the summer leading study abroad programs for UMass Lowell, sipping on some Basque cider and wishing that this life could last forever.
That sounds great. I think that might be the most beautiful setting description we've forever had on the podcast so far. Yeah.
There we go. Setting the bar for the next person.
I would love to start off with a reading from your story. Would you read the first few paragraphs for us?
Sure. Here we go. Igeri Larga, Lake Superior, 1974. A slight wind picks up and moves over the lake, clinking rocks together in the wash. Salvador squints into the darkness, the way his fellow construction workers talked about America's proximity. He'd half expected to sight the faintest outline of one of its city's skylines as a shimmer set deep against the horizon. Instead, there's only the night, and, stretching to meet it, the mumbling water. He pulls out at the cinch of his plastic bag, checks the knots of the floaters lining its perimeter, and slides his arms through the shoulder loops. Its belly is an airtight pouch that he hopes will keep dry his few possessions. A pair of pants and a shirt to change into once he makes it to the other side. 20 American dollars he purchased at a desperate rate. And a letter of introduction to Maria Sotelo, the cousin of a Catalan Marine from his ship. She works as a corporate attorney in Chicago, but the Catalan assured him she'll help him file for political asylum. He breathes in the scent of spruce and pine, fir needles, damp moss, and soaked through branches. He supposes he'll miss Canada. Slick and uneven stones are scattered underfoot, the water temperate from the long summer days. When it's at his waist, he turns to take in the bell-shaped silhouettes of the pine trees. Behind these, the forest is an opaque jawbone rising to the east, where, months before in St. John's, the Infante Carlos docked, and he and the other Marines and Cabos were given their final shore leave, 10 hours on land. So there we are.
Thank you for reading that. Would you describe what the piece is about, the plot in general, just for our listeners who won't have read it yet?
Yeah, so Salvador is about to, where he's stepped into the water and he's going to swim across one of the Great Lakes from Canada to cross the border illegally into the United States. And as he's, and it's, you know, at night, and as he's swimming at night, entering this body of water alone with him and propelling him forward are his memories of the home that he left. So from here, we bounce back to 1968. He's several years younger, of course, and the water also surrounds him there in that aspect of his childhood. And as the story progresses, the two timelines ultimately, come together at the very end.
Perfect. I would love to know how you came to write this specific story. Like, what germ inspired you to start work on it? What was the process like?
Yeah, it was a gift from someone I met at a wedding. The way that us Basques are, we tend to find one another in a crowd or be introduced. Amongst the many, someone would be like, wait, you're Basque? I know someone else who's Basque. And so that's what happened. I was at a wedding and someone's like, but you've got to meet, so-and-so, he's also Basque. I'm like, fantastic. And the wedding had already happened. This was the after party. We were around a gigantic bonfire and he was telling me about his grandfather who he's since returned to the Basque country. But this is what he did. He jumped ship in Canada and he swam across the border illegally, entered the United States, and met his wife, started a family, lived there for decades, and then ultimately returned home. During the time that he had left, Spain was it was the Franco dictatorship. So just like my father had done, left dictator-controlled Spain for better opportunities abroad. So he told me that. I was like, eating it up. And a few other details from, this is, I tend to write this way. Just give me enough to kind of like spark my imagination, and then that's kind of what I need to go. So I got back to Boston probably the following day, and started working on the story. And about a week later, I had a first draft of it.
That's so great. I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about how you wove together those two time frames in the story. You know, I think that's a tricky balancing act. And did you have to work at balancing them and to make sure that each one felt sort of equally alive and real?
Yeah. Again, this was a gift from this person. I had three details that he'd given me. And the other was that his grandfather as a child would, part of competition, because the Basque Country, like I said, is pressed up against the coast here. Water is a part of our lives. And so he was a really good swimmer. And he would, it was some odd, I'm not entirely certain exactly what the competition was, but they would dive for medallions. Like someone would flick a medallion into the water, and then they would dive for it, a group of boys, and whoever would manage to catch it would win. And so that is the second scene in the story. And so I had those two. You know, it's like, okay, I've got this character who's entering the water at night, 18, 19 years old. And then he kind of submerges, and it felt like a really natural place for him as a child than to break out of the water, having claimed the medallion. And, and the people who are betting on him are these Spanish police who have kind of been called to the region because of the political unrest that's arisen because of ETA. The 1968, they begin their campaign fighting for an independent Spain against a dictatorship at that point. So those were the two, and it really, one scene would conclude, and I felt like that was a natural place for it, and then I'd pick up, in the other, the kind of, what I would consider the present day action, which would be 1974, 1973. It felt like a really natural balance. I really didn't have to struggle too much with that. I suppose the real, for that first draft, the real struggle was then revising and editing and trying to keep that balance as I began shaving away aspects and including others. And that was really, the revision is where the real work came in. The writing of it, it came as a gift from this guy at the after party of a wedding, and then it was written as a gift from the muses. That part wasn't very difficult. The years and years of revision afterwards, that was a struggle.
You've lined me up perfectly for my next question, which is about revision. I know you worked on some revisions to the story with our editor-in-chief, Jennifer Acker. I've read earlier drafts of it. Would you talk a little bit about that process, either working with Jen on edits, but also just, how you did the edits yourself, as you said, for kind of years working on it on your own?
Yeah, it was, it was somewhat revelatory, Jen's notes for the story. Before that, I have a process which you would think that I would have learned better at this point, but after about a decade of doing this, it's constantly renewable, and I enter into it as if I'd never done the thing before. I've honed the story, I've revised, worked on, revise it for, I tend to revise the story for well over a year, quite oftentimes, 4 or 5. And then I give it to my wife, who's also an editor. People might say like, you're your own worst critic, et cetera, et cetera. But my wife is a fantastic editor. These stories are always elevated, you know, after her notes. And then I go back to it again, and quite oftentimes another year will pass of working on this thing. And then I'm quite convinced that the story is going to be, you know, just the second I submit it, you know, 24 hours later, like some editor is going to be thanking me so much for this, and they can't wait to publish it. And instead, what usually always happens is, you know, I'll only submit to a few journals, like maybe two, three, possibly four, and then I'll start getting the rejections, and it allows me, you know, a fresh pair of eyes to the story that one would think that I could do at this point, you know, just having done this for so long, just assume that the stories will be rejected and move forward from there. But no, so the stories get rejected, and then the fresh pair of eyes are looking at this. Okay, why did a reader say no to this? What is it missing? What does it need? And that process, like I'm kind of like a band who will road test a song, you know. I really inflict it upon a whole lot of stadiums and audiences as I continue to hone it and, you know, tighten the screws here and there. So that was going on for several years, you know, and over the course of like maybe, you know, a year, like maybe like three or four, you know, magazines have said no to it, but it again allows me that new perspective. The problem though is that I found with this story, and I realized only after the fact, after I received Jen's notes, is I was really just kind of, you know, there with the scalpel, trying to get it right, just trying to refine it, trying to get it to sing. And Jen's notes, you know, there was nothing, you know, no, I take that back. There were some very specific things, but it was more general than anything else. And for some reason, it was a sort of aha moment for me. And I was like, okay. So essentially, like, I took, you know, the entire engine out of the car, and I spread the parts across the front lawn. And I was like, okay, I'm going to put this thing back together now. And you know, and for the first time in a long time, the story really excited me after that. So that was such a gift from Jen, those notes, because again, it was a shift that I needed, because I'd been kind of locked in this, you know, approaching the story in the revision process with, you know, with the scalpel, and I really needed to change that approach.
Yeah, that is a real difficulty with revision in general. I definitely have experienced that, where like that time when you spread everything apart and, you know, take everything apart and work on it always feels like the early stage, and it's almost impossible to do that again at a later stage, because you feel like you've already got it and you've already been, you know, you've already been tweaking the sentences for a year. Like, I can't go back and take it all apart now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a great editor will always make you do that.
Yeah, it was, I'd convinced myself that this is the form that this story needed to be in, and that these sentences, you know, had been polished so much that they shone, and it wasn't the case at all. But it really took, you know, Jen's eye to be able to recognize what was working with the story, what wasn't working. And I don't know, there was something just about her notes that I was like, okay, like, I'm going to take this whole thing apart now. I was reading a lot of Kevin Berry last summer, when I received her notes, and Kevin Berry and I are completely different writers, but there was one thing about his writing that I felt I recognized I needed to incorporate into mine. And that was some humor, that you could have humor in short stories. And, you know, I suppose so many of us are, you know, if you read like the modernists, like, they're all so serious, and I convinced myself that that's what good literature is, you know, even having like stopped reading them for quite some time, I'm like, that's what literature is. And then Kevin Berry just like, oh no, wait, like, you could have sentences be funny. You could have scenes be funny, and the story will be, a much more exciting read as a result. So again, no reader would ever read the story, I think, and be like, oh yeah, yeah, I see Kevin Berry all over this thing. But having just, tore through everything that he's put between two covers and Jen's notes, both of those things at the same time allowed me what I needed to take this whole story apart and put it back together.
That's great. That's so interesting. So I know that you have published other stories from the perspective of Basque fighters or people living and struggling during that time period. So I'm going to ask you a couple things. It would be great if you could give us like a 20-second history or explanation of the conflict.
Oh, boy.
Just in case our listeners don't, you could go longer, of course, but just in case our listeners don't have a really good frame of reference for what we're talking about.
I will try to be as brief as possible. So in 1936, there was a Spanish Civil War. The Basques sided with the Republic, with the democracy. It was a nascent democracy, and they sided with them against the Franco-led military coup. Franco had assistance from Mussolini and Hitler, and they made a point of destroying the Basque country, Guernica, as likely most people know it. It was the first carpet bombing of its kind in human history. The city was demolished, and before that, there was Durango, which was a test run for Guernica. And that sort of destruction and oppression of the Basques continued on through the entirety of the Franco dictatorship. In response to that, ETA, which was a Basque separatist group, a terrorist organization, they began as college students who were trying to preserve Basque culture. It was illegal to speak, to use Basque names for a social event. Headstones in cemeteries with Basque names were being vandalized. Franco's idea of Spain did not include the regional distinctions that make this country such a wonderful, beautiful place. So there was no Catalonia, there was no Basque country, right? It's all Spain. And the Basques, who had been here long before anybody else had been, right? The Basques, well, I've gone way beyond 20 seconds. I just realized.
No, it's okay. No, keep going.
Right. Nobody knows where the Basques came from. They're a pre-Indo-European people. They've always, so long as there's been any sort of, even before any sort of recorded history, the Basques have been here. And so they did not take kindly to this idea that their culture should be, made extinct because of Franco's authoritarian, totalitarian, fascist plan for Spain. So a group of students were trying to preserve the culture and preserve the language, right? It was illegal to teach it. And of course, if you get a bunch of college students together, they're going to be, talking about the situation and what can we do to, I'm generalizing, being incredibly reductive here, but, how might we bring about the sort of change that we want from this ETA? Began first as a student organization, but there was a rift in the organization. Several or a large number of its members wanted to make it a violent movement. This is the 1960s. They were not unique. There were all sorts of violent or military-esque uprisings occurring across the globe. And in response to that, the Basque country would become the even into with the return of Spanish democracy, would be the most heavily policed region in all of Europe. So this is the world in which Salvador, the protagonist of this story, finds himself in making, trying to make the decision, how do I behave in this? His father had fought in the Spanish Civil War, and he's not a fan of his father's, and he doesn't want to fight his father's fight. And yet the community that he comes from, really leaves him very few options. So this is what he is, he finds himself in considerable conflict. Should he stay? Should he fight this fight? Should he leave home? His only real opportunity to leave home, though, requires him to first enlist in the Spanish military, because it was compulsory. Everybody had to serve the Spanish military for 2 years. So his way out requires him to enter into the military, which would then, quite likely, he predicts, cause him to turn against his own people. So this is the historical context at that point in the story.
Mm-hmm. So how did this become a focus for you in your writing? Like, is there a reason that this is something you revisit a lot in different stories?
Yeah. I think I fell into the same sort of trap that so many young writers do, in my 20s. For me, I'm Basque. My father's from here. My mother's family's from the French Basque country, from Iparralde. It's a place I came to as a child. I studied abroad here for an entire year when I was in college. I'm part of the Basque diaspora back home. From the age of 4 to 18, I had to do Basque dancing, dressed up in a pretty ridiculous outfit, but I'm all for it now, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And just, my father's a rancher, my family, sheep and cattle. And so that was, like so many Basques who went to the United States at that time. So that was my, that was my childhood spent. It was primarily sheep. We didn't get cattle until I was in high school. And it was not the sort of life I necessarily wanted for myself. And so, you spend that time dreaming yourself away from, from the place in which you find yourself. And in my 20s, the idea that I would write about, write about home and write about the place where I came from, is finally, in college and then living abroad. And I was like, why would I ever dream myself back there? Like, I spent my entire life, trying to leave. And then that young trap that catches most of us, you take a look at what's being published, you take a look at what's being celebrated, and you're like, okay, well, I'll write that kind of story. This is what's getting the attention. I'm going to be the next, X. Like, what, name your writer. Like we've all, or not we've all, but many of us have spent a good many years, emulating those that we most admire. And so that was my 20s. And it wasn't until the tail end of them into my 30s that, without really much intent, I sat down, in front of the computer, and I had an image, in San Sebastian, a scene, and I had no idea what was going to happen next. I didn't know why this guy was hanging out at this cafe. One scene kind of presented itself, the next moment or the next sentence, followed the one that I was writing. And it felt good. It was like, oh, this is how I used to write. This is how I used to dream. That took place here in San Sebastian. And then you tweeted something recently about having completed your novel. And I'll probably do a really terrible job of paraphrasing it, so my apologies, but that you've, after so many years of working on it, You know, you've completed it, but it began with you telling, it might've been your sister or a friend in a cafe that, that you had a really good idea for a piece of flash fiction. And all these years later, you've finally written your, you know, you've completed your novel rather. So, you know, I have like all these stories kind of stem from a moment. I could see it from the window here, Paseo de Salamanca. I had a character walking down the street and there was a, like a new patch of concrete, because, part of what ETA would do, there'd be car bombs, either as a warning or as an assassination, attempt. And so in, you know, my fictional world, there was a car bomb that had gone off there and hence the new patch of concrete. So I had a character walking down. And I was like, well, you know, maybe I should tell the story of how that patch of concrete got there. And so I told that story and, it came from the time that I was living here, towards the tail end. This is year 2000. There were four, ETA members who were applying a car bomb underneath an explosive underneath a car, and it detonated prematurely while they were attaching it, and they all died. And, you know, I thought there was something, you know, as tragic as it was, I thought there was something symbolic in that. And so this is, you know, so I'm like, so I'll kind of tell that story. And of course, you know, you think that you're going to tell that story and the characters never even get to the street because the story takes you off someplace else. But nevertheless, you know, you sense terrible things are going to happen to these people. And so I was like, okay, I told that story. Now I could get back to my, you know, to my character walking down the street. He could continue his walk. The poor guy's only taken a few steps. And then, you know, a number of days later or something, like I see one of the people who died in the explosion. I see her mom and she's trying to find her daughter. Because this is Paseo de Salamanca, it goes along the Urumea River, and her body wasn't found because they you know, the authorities suspect that it was blown into the river, that she died there. But her body hasn't been recovered, so she has hope that her daughter's alive, and so I see her and I'm like, oh well, I kind of need to tell this story now, and so the character is. Is walking the city, you know, Donosti here, San Sebastian, and trying to find her daughter. And at that same time, then I see this character's this teenage girl who died in this explosion. I see her grandfather, who's an idea comes to me for a story of his during the Spanish Civil War, and so then, you know, what follows is years writing these two timelines. Thinking that this is going to be my book, you know, follow the family in the contemporary sort of timeline, and then every other story. So one takes place present, one takes place in the past. And we follow the grandfather through the Spanish Civil War, and so convinced that this is going to be the book now. But you know, all this time I've got like these other voices, these other characters from the Spanish Civil War who want to tell me their stories. But I'm like, no, I've got this fixed idea of what I think this book is. And then finally, like I let, you know, only months ago, I kind of let go of that idea. I'm like, okay, all of you other characters, like what do you have to tell me about the Spanish Civil War? And so all this is to say that 10 years later, my poor character has only taken a few steps down that street and I've got a completely different book. And the one that follows will be, you know, this character, I'll be 60 or 70 likely by the time he actually makes it to his destination. yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I do think that, I've read a story of yours that I think is during the Spanish Civil War, that was the one that was in American Short Fiction. And I really loved it because it may not be super cool to like Hemingway anymore, but when I was a teenager, I was obsessed with Hemingway. And For Whom the Bell Tolls was my favorite book. I was a dark teenager. And, you know, I just think the Spanish Civil War is such beautiful, tragic, unmined territory for literature. And I'm so excited that you're writing about it. And that these characters have been able to come forward for you.
Yeah. It's been an exciting thing because at the time I knew a bit, of course, because my family's village is next to Guernica. My cousins live in Guernica. I've gone to Guernica, you know, since I was 10 or 12. And so that aspect of it has always been, you know, a part of my life, you know, the Spanish Civil War, but I really didn't know, you know, much more beyond that. First it was like a couple of books on my shelf and then it became a shelf. And now I think it's like three or four shelves in our living room are books on the Spanish Civil War. I now teach a class about it at UMass Lowell. You know, it was a dress rehearsal for World War II. It's kind of like the Empire Strikes Back of wars, assuming that you're opposed to fascism. You know, the good guys lost. And because of that, you know, everything else that followed would. And there's so many, you know, at times it could be a bit of a stretch, but to see the parallels to our present moment is, you know, could be pretty terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, my novel is also a historical novel. And so I have always found that the research can just be so instructive. Sometimes I swear it feels like cheating when you're doing research and you find out things that really happened, and then you can just put them in your book. You just put them in the book. It's amazing. But it really, you know, it adds so much richness that doesn't have to just come spontaneously from your brain, which I really enjoy.
Yeah, it's you know, some of the stories are I don't know. Do you have you ever watched the documentary Man on Wire? Philippe Petit.
I've definitely heard of it. I don't think I've watched it.
Oh, it's a fantastic documentary. But without really ruining anything, because I think we all kind of know what happens, right? He strings up a high wire between the Twin Towers, and he's going to do a high wire act between them. This is 1973 and 1974, I believe. And so there's a part towards the end of it where they've got the wires strung up, and he says, you know, it's the worst wire they've ever strung up because they have to break into the two towers in order to do it. And he says that normally he goes to, I'm trying to remember exactly I think he pronounced like Cavalletti, but I'm not sure what that is, but it's, you know, a high wire isn't just like one, you know, piece of cable. You have to anchor it is one piece of cable, but then you have to anchor it to either the ground, or because they can't go all the way down to the ground, to parts of the towers. And so usually you go out to the first Cavalletti says to kind of like figure out the rope, and I'm butchering whatever the actual word or term is. And then you go out to the middle, which is, you know, which can be pretty tenuous. And then you go out to the third to get a good sense of exactly, you know, what the cable does. But he says, you know, in that instance, he goes out to the first and he's like, that's it. I know all that I need to know. Now I'm going to dance. And so some of the stories that I've written, It's like that, like you just get a few details and you're like, okay, that's it. Like I know all that I need to know now, you know, now I'm going to write. But then there's others like the one that was in American Short Fiction. Like I really do owe, I really should be sharing writing credit, for that one with G.L. Steer, who was a British war correspondent at the time, and he covered the war here in the Basque Country. His book is called A Tree of Guernica. It was recently reprinted or republished by Faber and Faber. And it's an incredible piece of war correspondency. He is an amazing writer. As the Brits were, right, they've got this incredible stiff upper lip and this and just the sentences are gorgeous. It inspired the entire writing of that story. So with that one, I really do owe his estate, a considerable amount because that story, or I'm sorry, that book and his writing, would not have, or the story would not have been possible without it.
So you teach at the Honors College at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and in your classes, you've actually taught some issues of The Common magazine. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what do you think are the advantages of teaching from a literary magazine?
Me and my students, we love it. Recommend it to all of the listeners who are who also are fortunate enough to be teaching at universities. For my students, it's the first time that any of them have ever encountered a literary magazine. And despite the introduction that I give it, some of them are still surprised to find a poem followed by a short story, followed by an essay, followed by some work of art, and it takes them a little to realize that these aren't all by the same writer. They're really like an editor. So many of them are like an editor's dream because they'll read it from cover to cover, you know, following the table of contents. I have to admit that I oftentimes don't do that. One of the wonderful things about teaching The Common in particular is because it's a journal about place and about the way that place informs us. The students, you know, will acknowledge in their essays that, you know, they some of them, not all of them certainly, but some of them came from, you know, a slightly sheltered small town, you know, Massachusetts kind of life. And they weren't, I mean, they were certainly aware that these sorts of lives were lived elsewhere, but, you know, it's the power of literature to transport us into another person's, you know, shoes, into their struggle, into their plight. And it's, you know, it's like those aspirational qualities that we tend to, you know, give to literature, that it makes us more empathetic, that it opens us up to the rest of the world, to a greater understanding of the human condition, to the lives that are lived in this world that we share. It's like that. Like, it's really exciting for me because that happens so oftentimes for these students, you know, through their reading of The Common. And then, like, one of the things that I do, because the class that I use The Common in is also a class about place. It is a city as text. The city is Lowell, Massachusetts. And so then, you know, the students are tasked or given the opportunity to emulate or use as their thematic, structural, whatever it is, model, one of or several of the pieces in The Common, and to create a Lowellian homage to it. It's a first year writing class for a good many of them. They've never they've only spent a few weeks in Lowell. Others are from nearby towns, but it allows them a way to approach the city and to be creative. And quite oftentimes, you know, Massachusetts or UMass Lowell is like we have a really great engineering program. We have a really great nursing program, yeah, fantastic computer science program. So these, you know, many times the students have somehow convinced themselves that they're not very creative, even though, you know, all those majors require a considerable amount of creativity. Same with the professions that they'll soon be doing. So it's really, you know, it's wonderful to give them that space and that freedom to challenge themselves and to tell a story or to write poems, and to, you know, to reflect once more on the pieces that they discovered and that they really responded to in the common. So it's been a joy. I've been doing it for, you know, for a good many years now. And once more to all of the listeners out there, strongest recommendation that you do as well.
Thank you. That was the self-promotional part of the interview where we talk about how great the Common is for teachers. We do have teaching resources, free lesson plans, that kind of thing, discounted subscriptions for teachers, which is how Julian has been teaching the Common for these years. I studied abroad when I was an undergrad, since we're talking about college, and yeah, it absolutely changed everything about my life, like the entire course of my life.
Where were you for it?
I studied abroad in London.
Nice.
And then I did a year because I went to Smith College, and at Smith College, people usually study abroad for the whole year.
Great.
And they do to such a degree that if you stayed on campus, there would be almost no one from your year actually on campus. So I think it's wonderful.
Incentive.
Wow, yeah, I think it should be like required. I think everyone should have to study abroad.
Me too. And I think America would be a much better place if we could somehow subsidize that experience for, you know, for our college students. Like,
yeah.
I think the message that certain politicians teach, like they'll just fall on deaf ears because it becomes really difficult to be terrified of the rest of the world once you've actually encountered it.
Right. Absolutely. And I think it's just such a broadening experience for students. And also, you know, I later lived in England as a grown up after I studied abroad. And so I also know that studying abroad is one of the only ways you can travel and stay in some of these places, like in terms of visas and things like that. You can't just decide you want to move to Italy after you graduate, you know, like education is one of the only ways you will be allowed to do that. And you've actually taken students to Cuba, which is definitely one of those places where education is just about the only way you can access it. Yeah.
Yeah. These days, especially.
Yeah. What do you feel like your students gain from these programs, or how do you try to make sure that the students are gaining as much as they can from those programs?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think for so many of us, you know, we tend to sing the same song. My study abroad experience for a year, my junior year of college, you know, I had the same exact responses as you did. Like, I can't imagine my life without it. Like, I'm not sure exactly, you know, the number of paths that laid before me, but after I studied abroad, you know, there were boulders before so many of them, because like, no, this is, you know, you by encountering the world, you encounter so much of yourself, and I was determined to find out, you know, more about you know, after my year here in Donosti in San Sebastian, that was it. I was off to the races. I spent most of my 20s working to make enough money to go off and travel, and I can't imagine who I would be without those experiences. So it's, you know, it's my hope to give that to the students. I remember this was obviously in the before times, but I remember like a New York Times article in the travel section. It was like, don't mean to offend this tourist organization. I'm not sure exactly what they were, but I think they were like promoting transformational experiences or something like that. And the reporter, you know, signed up for it, and he received like a bunch of platitudes, just a bunch of quotes, you know, trying to gear him up for this experience. And then they just like, you know, filled up the days with excursions. You know, between these hours, you're going to go to a winery. Then you're going to, you know, hop on the back of some animal or something. Then we're going to take you into like an artisanal whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty convinced that that's not where the transformation occurs. You know, for any of these programs that I lead, you know, we've got a framework. I like to think that I'm giving them, you know, a really sturdy sort of foundation. You know, I'm introducing them to the region, introducing them to the culture. You know, we do quite a bit there's quite a bit that we cover before we even take off, you know, hopefully providing them the sort of context that will give them the most from their experience here. But, you know, I know enough to know that they're, you know, the epiphanies aren't occurring during our time together. But I hope to be providing for them the foundation to where they can go off and they can, you know, encounter the city on their own. And through, you know, the discovery of the city, they're discovering so much about themselves. So that's what I hope to provide. The programs are pretty successful. They're pretty popular. I'm running three of them here this summer. There's only one other study abroad program in the entire UMass system. A professor is taking a group of students to Salamanca, also in Spain. So there's that one in Salamanca, and then there's our three in San Sebastian, Donosti. So the students are like, I love my honor students. I hope to always be able to teach them. They're so, you know, like I just left them about an hour and a half ago. We were up on Igeldo on the mountain, and just, you know, when we're parting, just they're so thankful. And they're so appreciative, and you know, and they immediately express that, and they're just so excited. And you know, one of them was saying, you know, yesterday was the, because I took them on a pincho tasting tour of the old part. They're like, yesterday was the best food I ever had in my entire life, and today it was the best views I've ever seen in my entire life. Every day is like the best of something. And so it's, you know, like last year, obviously with COVID, study abroad was put to a halt, and I was going to be taking four groups here to San Sebastian. The university canceled, the study abroad program in Madrid, just as I was going through security. And I couldn't take students to Cuba. And so, you know, I'll always be a traveler. I'll always be going out into the world. So I really wasn't lamenting the loss for me, but those students who, you know, that was the only summer, the only spring break, or the only winter that they could have traveled, and for them not to, you know, again, like how it served you and me, just how life affirming and transformational it was. That they're going to miss out on that experience. So my heart broke for them. I was trying to do all I could last summer. I was like, you know, the Basque Country is actually a lot safer than America is at the moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's say I take a group over there right now, but, wisely the university, just mm-hmm. It's like, no, that's all right.
Yeah, that is tough. You're right. I do worry a lot about the students who had to give up so much and you know, time mm-hmm. matters so much when you're that age. Yeah. One of our interns had to come home early. She was studying abroad in Ireland, and she just had to, you know, drop everything and come back. And I, you know, she's graduated now. That was her chance, and it's over.
Yeah. And it's, you know, what happens so oftentimes for my students is that they discover that they can travel. They, you know, they do get, you know, in this age of infections now, they get bit by the travel bug. And they're determined to chase that high. They're determined to see more of the world. They're determined to encounter more of themselves out in the world. And so it does lead to the next adventure. And so for these students that weren't able to have it, and now are graduating and will soon, you know, or quite likely now at this point, you know, have a job or be entering into grad school, whatever it might be, there's a chance that they won't be able to make it out here. And as a result, they won't travel as much, you know, in their adult lives, and they won't make travel a priority. And, you know, they won't comp, you know, and therefore they will compromise. I truly think that your life will be a much more wonderful thing if you do get out there. So I feel for that. I feel for that whole cohort who weren't able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. I think doing it when you're young, when everything is new and scary, is much more accessible. And thinking about doing something like, you know, backpacking across Europe or you know, traveling to India or something like that just seems so inaccessible. If you haven't done anything like that before, you know, feels impossible. Like, how do I even start planning that? How do I afford that? And then, you know, you end up just vacationing close to home, which I also do, but yeah.
And it's, you know, and you never know, like one trip will lead to the next. And so, you know, doors will open where they never were before. And so, you know, that's certainly how it went for me. You know, I spent a year here. I went back. I finished my senior year. Someone who I met here, he was like, what are you going to do after you graduate? I said, I've got no idea. He says, I'm thinking about backpacking through Europe for 5 months. I was like, that sounds like the sort of thing that I want to do. The two of us worked absolutely crummy jobs. I was in a tomato packing plant for like 4 or 5 months, just working 7 days a week, trying to get as much overtime as possible. And then we headed out over here, and then, you know, made friends with people here. You know, someone's like, I'm heading off to Southeast Asia next year. It's like, sounds good. Well, no, I think first I had a buddy who was going down to Brazil for the Fulbright. So it's like, Brazil it is. And then in Brazil, you know, like, might as well see as much of South America as I can. And then that other friend is, you know, off in Southeast Asia. So I'll see you over there. Let me just, you know, make enough in order to pay for the trip. And so, you know, so one leads to the next. It would never have, none of those would have occurred had it not, you know, it started during my study abroad.
Mm-hmm. So one last question that we always ask everyone, what are you working on now? What should we look for next from you?
Yeah. So, like you, heading over into World War II territory, just started work not too long ago on the second book. It takes place in the French Basque Country during World War II. The French Basque Country was split. Actually, there were quite a few borders between the you know, Vichy France and Nazi-occupied France. But then bordering those two were also the Spanish border, where people trying to leave, you know, either side of France were oftentimes smuggled into, which was obviously controlled by the dictator, Franco. And so it wasn't, you know, they weren't necessarily getting the warmest welcome here, but their chances of survival were much better than obviously in Nazi occupied France. And then even Vichy, who were, you know, oftentimes trying to out Nazi the Nazis, to prove why they should, you know, remain in their quote unquote sovereignty.
Well, that sounds so interesting. I feel like, you have tapped a part of World War II that we don't know a lot about, which, you know, as someone who just wrote a novel about a part of World War II that most people don't know a lot about, I feel like is very rich territory.
Yeah, you would think that everything's been written, but
you think.
I mean, that's what, like when I was like, okay, you know, because my character in the Spanish Civil War, that's as so many of them did, they fled the dictatorship or the fall of the Republic, and the reprisals, and they, you know, the Great Retreat happened over into France, where they were not given a warm welcome, right? They were put into internment camps, called concentration camps at the time. And it's a fascinating story. And so, like, I was like, okay, this is, because you work on a book for so long, I don't know if this is a case for you, but it's like, this is the one and only, I've got nothing after this. And then it's only as you begin to finish it, you're like, oh, that's what's coming up. That's what I'll be working on next. And so, you know, so then there was a bit of research, you know, you're just Googling, you know, hesitatingly, and you're like, please don't let there be, you know, some incredible novels that take place here in this time. Like, I hope no one's already written this story. And then it's, And then you're trying to actually find material on it. It's like, oh my God, no one's really written about this.
So it's
surprising. Well, one would think that they've all been written, and yet maybe we're halfway through.
Yeah, and you and I are doing our bit. Julian Zavalbayeskoa, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really great talking with you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. Thank you to you and Jennifer Acker and the whole team at The Common for giving this story such a wonderful home and an audience. I'm really, really excited by it. So thank you so much.
Yeah, we're so glad we could publish it. Listeners, you can read Julian's story, Igerilaria, and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.